It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll look at an effort to preserve one of Wisconsin's dying languages.
First, a new law from Republicans would push back the early retirement age for state employees.
One proposal from Senator Dewey Strobel of Saukville would raise the minimum retirement age for most state workers by 2 years. Another of Senator Strobel's proposals would use the highest 5 years of salary instead of three to set a state worker's pension payout.
Scott Bauer is here to talk about these laws. He's a correspondent for the Associated Press. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this new plan to change early retirement for state workers.
Yeah, there are a pair of bills being circulated right now in the state Senate by State Senator Dewey Strobel. And they're, neither one of these are new ideas. Both were introduced a couple years ago and didn't go anywhere. One idea would be that workers in the state retirement system would not be able to qualify for early retirement until they reach age 57 as opposed to 55, and it would also delay the minimum age for early retirement for police and firefighters from age 50 to 52. And then the other bill would say that when you become eligible for your pension, part of the calculation is based, your benefit is based on your prior three highest years of salary. And this bill would say it would make that 5 years worth of salary as opposed to three. So with the effect would possibly be that, you know, your pension would be lower because you're be looking at 5 years of your highest salary as opposed to the highest three. So those are the two ideas that are out there. They have yet to be formally introduced. They're still out there for co-sponsorship, but they're likely to get dropped later this month.
Now, Wisconsin's pension system is fully funded. What has Senator Strobel said about why he's looking to change early retirement now?
Right. So Wisconsin's pension system is, as you said, fully funded and has been for years. And Senator Strobel has a few points that he brings up when he talks about these bills. The one that would require you to work longer before you qualify for early retirement, one of the arguments that he makes is that the private sector isn't afforded the same, a lot of people who work in the private sector aren't afforded the same benefit of being able to retire at that young of an age. He also argues that people are working longer, living longer, so there's really not a need to have a retirement age that young, and that delaying it would help to solidify the retirement fund while it's not in trouble right now if you had people stay in longer and not draw down on, you know, their benefits at an earlier age. That would help the fund. Now, there has not been an actuarial study on this bill and what effect it would have on the fund, although Senator Strobel told me that he would support that being done. So there aren't any numbers yet to really show what the impact could be if this were became law.
Now, what kind of reaction has this gotten from those representing public workers and police and firefighters?
Right. As you might expect, they're not thrilled with this idea. The police and firefighters, at least the police union official that I talked with from the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, he made the point that, you know, this may actually cost the state more money because you would have people who are at the higher end of the salary range working longer, continuing to pull down their larger salary, forestalling some younger replacement who would, most likely earn less than they would. And from the police side, you know, another argument they make is that, the younger retirement age, early retirement age for them is purposeful in a lot of ways in that they don't want officers in their 50s and 60s running around trying to deal with criminals and do the job that police officers do. So that's the argument from their side. State employees make, similar argument in that they just don't feel like this is something that's really warranted, and it's just another attack on, they view it as an attack on public employees who have already gone through the whole Act 10 battle and everything else that we saw. And they, you know, they characterize it as a solution in search of a problem.
We're talking with Scott Bauer right now, correspondent for the Associated Press. He's joining us right now to talk about a couple of new proposals from Senator Dewey Strobel that would change early retirement for state workers. Now, as you said, Scott, these bills have been introduced before. They didn't get a hearing. Why not?
Yeah, they didn't get a hearing 2 years ago. You know, there just wasn't the momentum, so to speak, around the idea. This time around, we'll see what happens. You know, the Republican leadership in the Senate, State Senator Scott Fitzgerald, his spokeswoman wouldn't comment on the proposal, said he hadn't reviewed them yet. But there are, you know, there is a feeling, at least among the public employee unions, there's a concern that maybe this time around they may have a better chance of passage than they did 2 years ago. And again, you know, the bills haven't been introduced. There hasn't even been a chance yet for there to be a hearing scheduled or anything like that. But, you know, there is time. There's this fall when the legislature is back, and then there is next spring. When they'll be back again. So, you know, whenever you see a bill like this come up, of course, the folks most affected are concerned that it may go somewhere. And Senator Strobel is optimistic that it'll fare better than it did 2 years ago.
What do we know about how Wisconsin's policy for early retirement compares with other states?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't have an answer to that. My hunch would be is that it's similar to other states, but I would hazard to I wouldn't want to say that for sure, because I just don't know.
Based on what you've seen so far, reaction, is it likely that these bills would face significant opposition?
Well, remember, Republicans, they have a majority in both the Senate and the Assembly. This is Republicans have shown a willingness in recent years, as we all know, to look at the public worker benefits that are accrued in Wisconsin by Wisconsin workers. They've shown no fear of going after things that are fiercely opposed by those same public worker unions and folks. So based on what we've seen since 2011, I don't think anyone would be surprised if these bills got some attention and moved forward. The one thing that is a little bit different, though, is the pension. The state employee pension is in good shape. It's not a fund that's facing any kind of emergency or dire need for action. So you do get a lot of resistance from anyone. Any time there's an attempt to mess with that pension fund, there is a pretty strong pushback. Often it's bipartisan, and that tends to make it a little more tricky to kind of get bills like these passed. So we'll see what happens, but until leaders come up and say kind of where they are on this and where their members are, it's tough to know what the road ahead looks like.
Now, as you said, very early now, but have you seen any indication that, given Republican interest in close examination of public workers, has there been any support of these bills or any likely to come?
You know, there hasn't yet, although as we reported last week, the bills just went out for co-sponsorship. So lawmakers are just now getting a chance to sign on as co-sponsors. And so when Senator Strobel actually introduces the bills, we'll see then how many lawmakers have signed on as saying, you know, that they want their names associated with this, and that'll give us another clue as to where the support lies for these ideas.
In terms of immediate next steps, what should we be looking for?
I think the biggest thing right now is you know, the bills have gotten a lot of attention over the past few days. You'll have a chance for other folks to weigh in. Our governor is obviously running for president. He could be asked about this. You know, there's a number of people and groups that will have a chance to weigh in beyond just the folks you would expect would weigh in, like the public sector unions. And when you kind of see where these other people are coming down on the issue, both elected officials and other people, that's always a good harbinger of kind of what a bill's chances are of success. And so that those are some things to look for while we wait for the bills to actually get introduced.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, anytime.
That was Scott Bauer, correspondent for the Associated Press. He was with us to talk about two new proposals from Senator Dewey Strobel that would change early retirement for state workers. For more on this topic, tune in for the Big Question this Wednesday at 7. Joy Cardine talks with Republican State Senator Dewey Strobel and Democrat John Erpenbach about whether the early retirement age for state workers should be raised. A team of researchers from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire is working to preserve a little-known language that's still spoken in pockets of Wisconsin. Walloon, which is similar to French, developed in southern Belgium and was brought to Wisconsin in the 1800s.
The problem is that Walloon just isn't spoken much anymore in the state, and there's no written format of the Wisconsin dialect of the language, meaning without some help, Walloon could completely disappear from the state at some point in the future.
And that's where our next guest comes in. Kelly Beers is a visiting assistant professor of French at UW-Eau Claire. He joins us now to talk more about the effort to preserve Wisconsin's Walloon language. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So now, Walloon is a language that a lot of us may not be familiar with. What can you tell us about it?
Sure. Well, so you mentioned some of the basic facts. It developed in southern Belgium alongside, it's a language related to French. They developed in very similar ways, but developed into different languages. It is still spoken in southern Belgium, although there it is also on the decline, being replaced by French as the official language of southern Belgium. But it was brought over here in the 1850s with some immigrants who were looking for a new place to start their lives over after some economic hardships, potato famine, for example. And so they brought the language over with them, and so we just happen to have a little bit of Walloon in Wisconsin.
And we just have a little bit of Walloon to give a listen to. This is it in action in a YouTube video. This is an older couple from Sturgeon Bay, actually, playfully arguing with each other in Walloon.
Non, ça n'a rien. Mais je suis venu au monde en Belgique, mais vous, vous êtes venu au monde, vous savez.
Mais ça me fait rien.
Ça fait un sac, oui.
Mais bon, ça, il y a de 5%.
Eh bien, c'est ça, je suis 5% belge.
Et moi aussi.
Non, parce que c'est vos grands-grands-parents qui sont venus. C'est non. Mais je suis 100% belge. Parce que tu es venu au monde en Belgique, mais vous êtes venu au monde ici à ma mort.
Kelly, I don't speak French. If I heard people talking like that, I think, oh, maybe this is French, maybe sure. An accent that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, so anyone who is familiar with French will recognize a few words here and there. Other than that, it gets to be a little bit difficult to follow what the speakers are actually saying. So some people have said that Walloon is a dialect of French because they are so similar. But in a lot of ways, they're very, very different. And so for that reason, linguists will consider it another language.
Do you know how many people there are in Wisconsin who still speak Walloon, and are they passing it on?
It's really difficult to get a good sense of how many people actually speak it. Earlier we had guessed maybe there were about 30 speakers. The last time I made a visit, I was able to sit down with about 10 to 12 speakers all at once at an event. And so now 30 sounds like it might be a little low. So it's hard to come up with a really good number. It's under 100 for sure. It's just not clear whether it's more around 50. It's really, though, the oldest generation that speaks it and that hasn't been passed down to the younger generations, mostly for socioeconomic reasons, as English became more and more important for trading, for commerce. The younger generations just weren't encouraged to continue to speak Walloon. In fact, many children were actively discouraged from speaking it in the schools. Sometimes they were punished for speaking it. So there's a very sharp decline after that generation.
Talking to Kelly Beers, a visiting assistant professor of French at UW-Eau Claire, talking about efforts to preserve the Walloon language here in Wisconsin. As he said, under 100 people probably speak it now. What are the goals, Kelly, of this preservation project?
Sure. So with the numbers of people who speak this, it's really at this point a project of documentation and preservation. With numbers that low, it's hard to imagine bringing the language back at all in a way that it would be spoken every day. But what we'd like to do is make sure that there are recordings of it that are available for archives, for museums and such, so that the younger generations have access to be able to listen to it. So that's part of it is recording the language so that we have a record of it and so that we can study it. The other aspect is preserving the language as a part of the culture. So the community that is between Green Bay and Sturgeon Bay, they have a very distinct Belgian identity. They still identify with the Belgian culture, their Belgian history. So we'd like to make sure that the language is part of that so that people don't forget about it. So we're working with local organizations and schools, for example, to think of ways that we can promote the language and get kids interested in it.
Kelly, can you tell us a little bit more about what it is that we lose when we lose a language or a dialect of a language like this?
Yeah, there is. There's actually a lot at stake. On one hand, language is really closely tied to our identity, like I was just saying, and there's so much embedded in language that is related to culture and who, how we understand who we are. So, for example, the choices of words that are made, the way that words sound, the cadence, all of these things are part of a characteristic that language has. For anyone who has tried to translate a joke from one language to another, for example, knows that that's very difficult to do because humor is so reliant on the language itself, the way that words sound. Another thing that gets lost is the history that is embedded in the language. There are stories to be told in this language that that would be difficult to tell in English. You know, the nuances of emotions get lost, the word choices get lost. So there are all sorts of reasons that we should try to hold on to these languages in whatever way that we can, even if it's just in memory.
You're working with students at UW-Eau Claire on this project, as I understand it. What do they get out of this? What kind of experience will this be like for them?
So for them, on the one hand, they've been able to be involved in a pretty large-scale research project from start to finish. We just started this project a year ago. They've been able to think about how to design a project like this. They've been able to think about these big questions, what sorts of things are at stake, what are our goals. And they've been able to meet the people who speak this language and see on a very personal level what's at stake. And then on a more personal level, some of the students have, you know, they have different reasons for why they're interested in this project. One of them is actually descended from Belgian immigrants. So for her, this really hits home, I think, for example.
Do you speak the Wisconsin version of Walloon when we were playing that older couple kind of bantering back and forth? Did you understand a little bit about what they were saying?
I'm just starting to really sit down and try to learn the language. So I still do not understand it very well. I have to rely on what I know about French to try to pick out bits and pieces. But that's going to be another project in itself.
If somebody's listening and saying, hey, I still speak Walloon, or my parents or grandparents do, is there a way they can work with your project?
Absolutely. So anyone who's interested in working on this project, either because they speak the language or they're just interested in it, they could contact me if they're interested in working on the project itself. So they can send me an email. It's just BIRSKD@UWEC.edu. Another way that people could get involved is look into, there's a website called belgianheritage.org. And this is from the Belgian Heritage Foundation that is working on putting together a museum. They're working on kind of building a base of materials that they could put in the museum. And they're also looking for donations. And they put on events throughout the year. So that would be a good place to look to see what sorts of things are going on.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about preserving Walloon in Wisconsin.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kelly Beers, visiting assistant professor of French at UW-Eau Claire. He joined us to talk about his ongoing project to preserve the Walloon language here in the state. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A special report released by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services shows that more people died from drug overdoses in 2013 than from breast cancer, car accidents, or suicide. Drug overdose deaths in Wisconsin doubled from 2004 to 2013. And in 2013, opioid pain relievers were the reason for more deaths than heroin.
We're taking your calls, too. Do you or does someone you know struggle with drug addiction or substance abuse? Has opioid painkiller abuse touched your life? What measures do you think should be in place to address the problem? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Karen McEwen joins us now to talk about the report and what the Department of Health Services is doing to combat drug overdose deaths here in Wisconsin. She's the state health officer. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about drug overdose deaths in Wisconsin, Karen, is this something that's in a particular area or urban or rural Wisconsin in particular?
I know that a lot of times people do think that this is a problem that only happens in big cities, but that is not the case. These deaths happen across the state in rural communities as well as in the cities. So everybody should be paying attention.
And do we have data on who is most affected by drug overdose deaths in the state?
Sure. So one of the pieces of information we know is that people who die from drug overdose are most likely to be in their early 40s, and males are more affected than females. So that's some of the information that we have.
Do we know if these are people who have been addicted for a long time or new to the drug, or is that something that's still unknown?
People can die who have never used drugs before if they take too many. They certainly would not have tolerance, so it might take fewer drugs. But often these deaths do happen after a long history of addiction and struggling with addiction.
And the head of your department has described this as a public health crisis. Why is this a crisis now?
This is a crisis because not only have these deaths overtaken every other form, the other accident deaths that you mentioned, such as car accidents. So just to restate, more people today in Wisconsin are dying from drug overdoses than from car accidents, but the trend lines are also headed up. So it's not as though this has leveled off. This is an increasing problem, and we need to act quickly to reverse those trend lines.
And can you talk about the role of prescription medications in this overdose trend?
Sure. So when we look at overdose deaths, almost half of them were related to prescription drugs such as oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone. About 27% were heroin, so a lot fewer than prescription drugs. And what else we know is that people who take heroin often started by taking prescription drugs. So the prescription drugs are both causing deaths and may also be leading to heroin use, which then causes deaths as well.
How do we in Wisconsin compare with the rest of the country on these overdose deaths?
So Wisconsin is not the worst state. But it's a significant problem here. And as I say, because the trend is increasing, we're taking it very seriously. And Wisconsin is trying to intervene as early as possible and as quickly as possible, as many ways as possible. And that's being recognized at the federal level, so that even though we aren't the worst state in percent of people affected, we are still receiving grants to work on this issue.
Talking to Karen McEwen, she's the state health officer, looking at overdose deaths in Wisconsin. They are on the way up over time, and prescription medications are more and more commonly involved in those overdose deaths. You can join in if you've dealt with this issue for yourself, maybe in your family. Maybe you've worked with people dealing with addiction to these medications. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Karen, what do we know about the path from taking these medications, either because they were prescribed to you or you obtained them from someone else, to addiction and then overdose?
So we know that some people are more likely to become addicted to these medications, but that the risk factor is to be taking them. Now, these are medications that definitely have a use in treating pain, but can also be taken inappropriately and can lead to addiction. As you mentioned, sometimes that happens with people that have been prescribed the medications and maybe keep taking them after the pain is over. Or they can be diverted, so perhaps somebody had some pain medicines, didn't take them all, they're still in the medicine cabinet, and somebody else gets a hold of them. It could be teenagers in their family, family friends, and then people who were never supposed to be taking that medication can become addicted as well.
You mentioned intervention and some grants coming to the state. What are you doing at the Department of Health Services to start tackling this problem, especially with these prescription medications?
So we are taking a multi-pronged approach at the department, and we are working with partners throughout state government and in the private sector. And the two real focuses of our work are preventing this from ever happening. So trying to make sure that providers know how to treat pain as safely as possible so that people do not develop that initial addiction. But then we also recognize that there are a lot of people who have developed an addiction to pain medications or even to heroin, and so making sure that there are treatment options available to them and that the message is out there that addiction is treatable.
Is treatable, but it seems like it would be a lot easier to prevent it in the first place, as you were hinting at there.
Absolutely. Our goal is to prevent this from ever happening so that people don't have to go through the pain of addiction and through the what can be a very difficult treatment process.
Who needs to be at the table to get that prevention message, that prevention effort out there?
You know, you almost can't have too many partners at the table to get that message out. So we work with providers. Educators can help get the message out. Parents are obviously some of the most critical people just to be having those difficult conversations with their kids. And then peers are also helpful. So kids telling kids, don't do this.
How about medical care professionals? When people are prescribing, when pharmacists are dispensing, do they have a role to play?
Absolutely. Medical professionals who just have that conversation with their patients as they're prescribing, talking about what's the appropriate use of this, how long the individual should expect to be taking it, and what to do with any medications that are left.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. We have Linda on the line in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi. I've had this concern for a while. I fell and broke my arm. That is not my concern. But the doctor gave me a prescription for oxycodone with 24 tablets in it. I only use 3 of them. And so I wonder if, I'm sure the doctor was trying to make sure I was covered if I was in a lot of pain, but it seemed an awful lot of this dangerous drug.
Linda, thanks for that call. Kelly or Karen, is that something that people are worried about, over-prescribing or giving out too many when a prescription is made?
Linda, that is a perfect example of what we're trying to work with providers to do, just to recognize if you're having a minor procedure, you probably don't need 30 days worth of medication, which will then sit in your cabinet. So that is a perfect example of the type of work that we're trying to do with providers to make sure, again, that they do treat pain, but that they treat it in the safest way possible.
Thanks for calling. Yeah, thanks for calling, Linda, but that's a tough balancing act because, as Linda said, maybe she had a lot more pain and you're putting her through the effort of getting that prescription refilled, going out and getting that refill when you're wanting to stay home and nurse that broken arm. In this case, how are doctors drawing that line there?
It is a difficult question, and the provider is the one who ultimately has to make the decision. However, just they can base it on what's expected for the cause of pain, and then they can also work with the patient to have a plan on how the patient could get more. And I think also the more everybody is aware of this message and of the risks involved, the better understanding there will be that maybe your provider isn't going to give you a full month of pain medication right at the beginning before they know what's going to work, and you'll understand why that's going to be.
You hear concerns sometimes about doctor shopping or people going to different people who can prescribe so they can get more prescriptions and that information. No one provider knows exactly how many pills are going to this person. Is that part of the problem that you're trying to tackle?
Absolutely. So some of the work that we're doing is with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. That is an online program that contains information from pharmacies about what medications patients are taking. And providers can go onto that and find out right away, is this individual receiving the same medication from another provider? So that's an invaluable resource to help with this work.
We're talking to State Health Officer Karen McEwen about what Wisconsin is doing to address drug overdose deaths. We'll get to treatment of addiction in a bit. Those deaths are now the number one cause of injury deaths in Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls, too. Has a drug overdose touched your life? Does someone you know struggle with drug addiction? And what do you think Wisconsin should do to address the problem? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with State Health Officer Karen McEwen about deaths by drug overdose in Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to address drug abuse in Wisconsin, especially when it comes to pain relievers, prescription pain relievers? Do you have any personal experience with drug abuse? Does someone you know struggle with substance abuse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Karen, I mentioned we'll talk about treatment now. What's out there? What is available in Wisconsin for someone who realizes they are addicted to these prescription pain relievers?
I'm glad you're asking. If anybody who's listening does have a problem or knows somebody who has a problem, there are resources available. And so you can go to our website at dhs.wisconsin.gov/opioids/treatment to get a full listing. The most important thing is to recognize that you need help and to ask for help, and we would encourage you to talk to your healthcare provider. Every treatment plan is going to be different based on your unique situation, but the department is working to make sure that there are treatment options available across the state, and those can include medication-assisted treatment and other and counseling services, peer services. So, again, the critical thing is recognizing you need help, reaching out, and then we're working on our end to make sure that help will be available.
Are there gaps right now? Are there places around the state where people might not have a local option?
Different options are not available across the state, so there are options available, but specific options, there can be gaps. So, for example, we did just get a $3 million grant that is allowing us to expand medication-assisted treatment into Sauk and Columbia counties right now, and then we're looking to see if we could expand those further. So we continue to look across the state and see where might there be gaps in treatment options that would help people who are struggling with addiction.
You mentioned that part of the problem here is that it isn't just the prescription medications, the pain relievers themselves, but that in some cases people move on from those medications to heroin. How widespread is that in Wisconsin?
So heroin is an increasing problem in Wisconsin. Of the deaths that we reported, 27% of those are related to heroin. But we see other trends that are related to that as well, such as hepatitis C is increasing with the increase of heroin use, and that is something we're watching very closely, and we need to turn that trend around as well.
From a public health standpoint, since people are using either heroin, which is illegal in and of itself, or possibly using prescription medications illegally, is that an obstacle for people wanting to come forward and seek treatment?
So we encourage everybody to seek treatment, and certainly the legislators have looked at what can they do to help reduce those fears in critical situations. So, for example, if someone calls 911 when they suspect a drug overdose, there won't be prosecution for that person, even if they were at a party or whatever. So we want to encourage life-saving measures and reduce that fear that, well, we were doing something illegal. So, again, if there's an overdose or something like that and you call 911, then you don't have to worry that the police are going to come in and arrest you for that.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Karen McEwen, State Health Officer. She was with us to talk about the Department of Health Services' new report on drug overdose deaths here in Wisconsin.
Now we're focusing on one effort to solve the problem of painkiller abuse, a new marketing campaign aimed at raising awareness. That campaign is called Dose of Reality, Prevent Prescription Painkiller Abuse in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's Attorney General Brad Schimmel joins us now to talk about it. Attorney General Schimmel, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us, what is Dose of Reality?
Well, frankly, we called it Dose of Reality because we all need one. And this isn't just citizens. It's those to the medical community, too. Many in the medical community simply aren't aware of what's happening. We have 70% or almost four-fifths of the people who become addicted to heroin first started by becoming addicted. years now and made some big public attention to it, but it's time to now start talking about the root cause. And the prescription opiates, the pain pills that people get, are attractive because they aren't as frightening as heroin. But very few people who get prescribed them understand the danger of becoming addicted and then what is going to end up happening when you can't get your supply of your prescription anymore.
Is this a problem that just kind of snuck up on us in Wisconsin? Heroin, everybody kind of knows about and has been worried about for decades, really.
It hasn't snuck up on all of us, but it has kind of snuck up on the medical community. I have talked to thousands of doctors in the last 2.5 years since I started kind of beating the drum on this problem, and I have found across the board that very few of them understood what was happening, how these drugs were being diverted, and how they were becoming the source of heroin addiction.
In Dose of Reality, how are you going to be working to raise awareness of this issue?
Well, one of the things we do is take on the myths, like the myth that this only happens to the bad kids. Because of that, a lot of parents think that they can relax. They don't have to worry because it's not their neighborhood. It's not their child. When the reality is it's affecting urban communities, suburban, rural communities equally. And it's kids of all economic and social structures. It cuts across every kind of divide we have or every kind of category we have in society. And, you know, as I met at VA, I met with many, many parents who unfortunately buried their children because of drug overdoses. And those parents were desperate to prove to me that their kids weren't the bad kid. And frankly, I've now met hundreds of parents who have buried their children. Not one of them thought for a moment that their child was the bad kid. There's also a myth, too, that people are getting these prescriptions directly from their doctor, and that's how they're becoming addicted. 70% of the people who become addicted to prescription pain medications are getting them improperly from family or a friend. So we're going after the abuse. These medications have legitimate and responsible uses when they're used properly and under proper medical care. But when they're diverted, someone's using a medication that wasn't prescribed to them, either to abuse or to take care of their own pain on their own, that creates tremendous danger. And that abuse is what we're after with this campaign.
We heard earlier from a caller who had been prescribed, I think she said, 30 pills. She used 3 of them. And I imagine there are a lot of stories like that where there are these pills just kind of out there. I know part of your effort is to have a drug take-back day so those don't fall into the wrong hands, don't get used by the wrong people. How would that work?
Well, we've been doing the drug take-back day for years now. For about 4 years, the DEA did this or managed it along with state resources. In May of this year, DEA didn't get involved, and we took it on at Wisconsin Department of Justice. We're back working with the DEA this fall, and we'll be doing it again on October 17th. In addition to preventing the abuse, we also want to make sure people understand the importance of safely storing the medication. None of us would leave a loaded handgun sitting on our kitchen counter with teens coming in and out of the house. And yet, we don't think twice about these medications in our medicine cabinet. Prescription opiates are killing far more people than handguns. They're killing more people now. Drug overdoses are killing more people now than motor vehicle crashes. So we need to pay attention to how we store these medications so they don't end up in the wrong hands. And we also need to pay attention to how we dispose of them, because I do want people to get rid of them, but take them to your local police department, and they have medication return units at many police departments now. You can go to our website, doseofrealitywi.gov, and you can actually search by your zip code and find out the closest medication return unit to you. Get those medications there, because we collect them on the drug take-back day, and we take them to be safely incinerated.
And that drug take-back day, the next one's coming up October 17th, is it?
Correct.
And so what happens especially on that day if people any day can go to their local police department? What kind of extra efforts out there for that?
Well, on that day, there will be locations where they can turn them in, but I'd encourage people not to wait until October 17th. If you're not using this medication, take it to the police department, put it in the medication return unit. There are no questions asked. There's no one going to check up on who you are or what you're depositing there. Put them there, get rid of them, And then the police departments will get them to us to organize them and bring it all into one place October 17th. And then we load them up into semi-trucks. In May, we collected just under 20 tons of prescription medications to be destroyed. That's great news on the one hand, because now those medications aren't in medicine cabinets. They're also not in our water table. It's bad news on the other hand, because it demonstrates that we are being overprescribed. Now, one of the important things, too, is to think about this, that in the 20 tons that we collected, that did not include Milwaukee and Dane County. They did separate collections, so our two biggest counties weren't even part of that.
Attorney General Schimmel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Wisconsin's Attorney General, Brad Schimmel. He was with us to talk about a new marketing campaign aimed at curbing prescription painkiller abuse. The campaign is called Dose of Reality.
Great Pumpkin, I'm looking forward to your arrival on Halloween night. I hope you will bring me lots of presents.
It's a little early for Halloween and that visit from the Great Pumpkin, but there's reason to celebrate the season, and maybe a little early here in Wisconsin.
The cause for celebration, a pumpkin at the Cedarburg Wine and Harvest Festival just tipped the scales at 2,000 pounds. That makes it the largest pumpkin in North America, by the way. It was grown in Illinois by a farmer named Gene McMullen, who carted it across the border to take the prize at that Cedarburg event.
This is the Paul Bunyan of pumpkins. Gene, congratulations. You've done us proud and gotten some envy from me. I would hate to have to carve, I don't know, how would you carve that? A knife wouldn't do the job.
Well, it already takes so long, at least for me, to carve one of those, especially when they have a thick, you know, hull or whatever you call it,
right,
on a pumpkin. Imagine scooping out hours later. But imagine what a cool jack-o'-lantern that would be.
I think some kind of industrial, like, pneumatic thing to shoot the pumpkin innards out. Well, I say I'm envious because I had some pumpkin plants this year. I've done okay with baking pumpkins in the past this year. So far, I've seen one really tiny. When I came out one morning, something had gnawed off the stalk. So I have, it's like maybe 2-3 inches in diameter. So it's
a small pumpkin.
Decorative baby pumpkin on our table. I will not be trying to cook with that this year.
Well, something to look forward to, getting us ready for the fall season and Halloween season, too. Congratulations, Gene.
And pumpkin spice season, as our producer Chris Molina keeps reminding us.